Welcome, I'm Tom Martin, and this is Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of 1, the Alltech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. Okay, up front, I have a thing for rail travel. I miss it, a lot. As a teenager growing up in Moorhead, not yet old enough to drive a car, I could hop aboard the Chesapeake and Ohio, the C&O as we called it, and travel the 60 or so miles over to Lexington to spend a weekend with my grandparents, and then on Sunday afternoons reverse the whole wonderful adventure, watching the Kentucky countryside glide by, sometimes over a meal in the dining car. It was comfortable, safe, and efficient, and it's long gone. But recently I came across a glimmer of hope, not only for rail travel, but quite possibly for an eastern Kentucky town as well. Chris Campbell loves rail travel, and that's why he leads the Kentucky Steam Heritage Corporation. Chris is here to tell us about his organization and an interesting and exciting effort they have underway in Estill County as part of the redevelopment of the economy of Appalachian Kentucky. Greetings, Chris.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. First, if you would tell us a little bit about railroad, what's it mean to you?
People see railroads as things that get in the way that slow you down on your way to the grocery store. And I think for me, it's been, especially this project, has been an exploration of the people and the pride that people took in the work in the railroad industry, especially when it was the main source of travel in America. So for me, it's an exploration of the history of our country, how it got from point A to point B, and then, of course, the story of the people that helped make that happen and how it was ingrained in our society as a good thing before I feel like in modern times that it's seen as more of an inconvenience, and that's just kind of a product of how our nation gets around. So for me, it's a personal exploration into the psyche of America and how we treat transportation and the fact that at one time it was a glorious and very seen high in society as a job to work on the railroad. And the stories that we were getting from the people as we do this project are coming out. It's a personal exploration for our group just to kind of go back and see how America views the way they travel.
Okay. And later on in our conversation, I want to come back around to the future of rail travel, and we'll do that. But for now, if you could just tell us about Kentucky Steam Heritage, what's its purpose? What's its mission?
Our mission as a 501c3 is to revitalize old pieces of rail equipment and make them work again and tell the mechanical history. It's an interesting history. It's a personal history. The old pieces of rail equipment required significant amount of manpower to keep them going, significant amount of technical skills training for very specific jobs. And we want to tell the story of the men and women who made those vehicles work, and that's our mission, is to tell that story. And then, of course, that involves a very large piece of tourism piece. You know, we want to bring tourism and go away from the regular museum concept and make it an interactive experience, so people that come see what we're doing can get immersed in it and to see what it was like when people did this kind of work on a day-to-day basis.
And toward that end, your group has a project underway that could breathe new life into Ravenna, which is a town of about 600. It's located in Estill County near the Kentucky River. Tell us about that.
Well, Ravenna was actually founded by the L&N Railroad. When there were several railroads racing into the coal fields in eastern Kentucky back in the early part of the 20th century. And the L&N bought up some of the smaller railroads and consolidated them as they were going east to try to extract the coal. And that was a major milestone to get to Ravenna, because Ravenna was the largest and flattest piece of land. Of course, then it wasn't even Ravenna. It was Irvine only. And the L&N founded their own town there. And Ravenna itself was founded because it was a place for railroad workers to live while they worked across the tracks at the shops that were established there. So the reason that we wound up there is simply because the infrastructure that was put in place over 100 years ago has been essentially downgraded into almost nothing. A lot of it is still there, but it's not being utilized. So it gave us an opportunity to say we could get something that's already extant, repurpose it, use part of it for what it was intended for as a rail yard, while at the same time infusing the local economy with a tourist attraction, so to speak. And that's what drew us to that spot, because it made sense, and it was also very attractive in terms of we could really do something good for the community there.
Okay, listener, if this is piquing your interest and curiosity, you can actually take a look at it. Chris has shared with us a rendering of the planned Kentucky Rail Heritage Center, donated, the rendering, that is, by Sherman Carter Barnhart Architects. We have it on our website, esweku.com. Just click on the Facts and Information tab. The Kentucky Steam Heritage Site is simply kentuckysteam.org, so you could go there. But if you're driving and can't write it down, you'll find a link to that on our site as well. Chris Campbell, Kentucky Steam Heritage just received a contribution in support of this project. Who from and what for?
We have been very, very slowly and methodically releasing and information about this project when we have definites. And there's been very few definites so far because we've been feeling out the landscape of this thing. And, developing the concept of the Rail Heritage Center was a big part of to getting other people involved in it, because we didn't have anything to show for what we were doing other than we had ideas. When we got together with Sherman Carter Barnhart, they were fantastic in working with because they got the vision immediately. We weren't married to a certain concept. We developed it. And their creativity and insight was important. So when we were given those renderings, then we began to start marketing the fact that we have an idea here. We want to bring money and interest into Eastern Kentucky. We felt like that Ravenna and Estill County in general is a great gateway to Eastern Kentucky. So the Milburn Group, based in Covington, they do a lot of hospitality-based projects in Northern Kentucky. They had been following us for some time, and Tony Milburn, the founder and CEO of their company, approached us. We entertained them a few weeks ago down at the site, showed them our vision, shared with them what we really thought the campus should look like, and we asked his opinion on what type of vision that he saw from a hospitality standpoint. And our vision's very closely aligned. And we fostered a very nice, obviously a very good relationship in a short amount of time. I think it's important. It's definitely important for Eastern Kentucky to bring investors and money and interest in from elsewhere, not necessarily to replace what's going on in Eastern Kentucky, but to exacerbate the energy that's sometimes only going to be able to be developed with outside money. And Tony and his group were very enthusiastic about what we're doing down there in Eastern Kentucky and Estill County. And, you know, his trust that they have has contributed $50,000 towards developing what we hope to be a very large event space that will not only house a restaurant, but also a venue to entertain, and will be right across the tracks from our center of operations. So the concept for the Rail Heritage Center is not just to be a rail attraction, it's to be a rail-based attraction. So there's things to do there besides just going see trains. It's not a concept that's really been seen very much in this country in terms of diversifying how you market yourself as a rail attraction. And, we want to make sure that we aren't just a one-trick pony. We like trains. Some other people aren't. In fact, the vast majority of the population probably doesn't understand the importance of rail travel, especially how it's historically affected America. And, you know, for some of these other things that are going on there, somebody comes to eat, comes to a banquet, has a wedding reception, and then they see these cool things going on there and they get interested kind of by happenstance. And vice versa. You may get somebody there that's really interested in the trains, and next thing you know, they see a concert going on at the pavilion that we're going to build, or gets a bite to eat at the restaurant. So it's a concept that we haven't necessarily really seen in this country very much, and we're hoping to be at the forefront of developing something like that. And the Milburn Group's contribution is huge for this.
Have you put a ballpark price tag on the concept?
The concept, probably full in, we're saying around $7 million when it's all said and done. That's not going to be a one-time investment. It's going to be something that evolves over a long period of time. It's a big project. It involves a lot of different things, but our goal is to get multiple partners involved in this. This is not something that's going to be a one-trick pony to where we're going to bring in one person and they're going to contribute it all and it all be done in a year. We really want it to be something that comes up and morphs over time, because it's definitely an ambitious project, but it can't happen without some keystone pieces to it. And the keystone pieces are the infrastructure that's already there that we're repurposing. And then, of course, hopefully what we see is a 12,000 square foot venue to be able to bring people on that campus to entertain.
And check me if I'm wrong, Ravenna is not all that far off I-75. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've driven to Ravenna a lot over the past year since we've started this whole endeavor, and it's straight down Highway 52, which is a very wide two-lane road, very modern, and that runs directly off of 75, and it's about 22 minutes from the exit up there in Richmond. So I feel like, as somebody that grew up in Lexington, Eastern Kentucky, and non-Fayette County, things seem so far away because a lot of times we get stuck in the urban bubble that we're in. But from door to door, if you're leaving northern Fayette County, getting on I-75 and heading down there, it's around 45 to 50 minutes.
That's so it's nothing in urban terms.
Correct.
So, Chris, when you hear all this talk about investing and beefing up our infrastructure in this country, does your mind go to rail travel for something in the future?
It certainly does, and for the reason that I feel like that starting in the 50s and going for several decades, we began to kind of devalue rail as a linchpin in the way that we move product and people. And I think that in a lot of ways we're regretting that trash mentality. We just got rid of so many rail lines and discontinued passenger trains. We fell in love with the interstate system in the 50s and 60s. The automobile became the primary way that we got across the country. And now we're realizing that the infrastructure itself is so incredibly expensive to put back after you've taken it out, that it's really hampering us in a way that we probably couldn't have conceived 50 years ago. And I do think rail travel is something that we look at other countries, especially Western Europe, and you see how easy it is to get from point A to point B without hopping in a car. And the more the population grows in this area, the more gridlock happens on the highways and the roadways. As a resident of Lexington for most of my life, I'm quite familiar with how different the traffic is now than it was 15 years ago in Lexington. And it would be nice if we still had a rail system, especially a light rail system that we once did in the early part of the 20th century to get from Nicholasville and Versailles to Lexington. That's something that we've kind of thrown away. And I think that when we do talk about the infrastructure being beefed up in this country, it's going to have to, in a lot of ways, embrace rail travel again, not necessarily heavy rail, but a lot of times light rail. And we've seen some communities, especially in the East, that are going back that direction again.
Well, maybe the Kentucky Rail Heritage Center will spark interest in that again and get people to begin imagining that kind of travel again.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times people think of railroads as antiquated and old technology. And we're definitely going to tell a story of that old technology because it's just, frankly, it's neat to see. But rail use itself can also be put in a modern context. And while it's not our mission to do that, like you said, it may be very important to get people to pique people's interest into what rail really is, what it really was to our country, and what it can be again.
Chris Campbell is president of Kentucky Steam Heritage. Thanks so much, Chris, and good luck with this project.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Take the last train to Pottsville, and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30, because I've made your reservation. Don't be slow.
Still ahead after a brief break, Lexington writer Margaret Verbal on her new book, Cherokee America.
Cherokee America deals a lot with the illegal immigration of white people into the Cherokee Nation. And in fact, about half of the book is about that.
We have Margaret's conversation with Bill Goodman of Kentucky Humanities. And was it something she said? Beth Davison of the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce is back to drill down into a subject she brought up in passing during a recent appearance on Eastern Standard, degree regret, and how we can get better about aligning education with jobs. Later in the hour, the details on Critical Mass 3, a day of discussion about how to boost critical review of the arts in the Ohio Valley region. And coming to the Kentucky Horse Park, the Arts Council's Kentucky Crafted Market.
It's the best art and craft under one roof that you're going to find all year in the state of Kentucky.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th to 21st, 2019 in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In the course of a conversation with Beth Davison on a recent Eastern Standard, Beth, who is executive director of the Kentucky Chamber's Workforce Center, mentioned something that screamed for a follow-up, degree regret. How many realize that, in retrospect, that college degree they worked so hard to achieve was in the wrong field? Well, I invited Beth to come back and drill down into that question a bit. Thanks for coming back, Beth.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me back.
So you've pointed out to me this report from Strata Education Network and Gallup that's entitled On Second Thought, very aptly titled, On Second Thought, U.S. Adults Reflect on Their Education Decisions. What's the purpose of the research?
So the purpose of the research is to really understand how people feel about their post-secondary purchases and the decisions they make. If you think about it, we're here in Lexington, downtown Lexington. If you and I were to go have dinner after this, or if you were going to go home and make some purchases on Amazon tonight, anything that you wanted to buy as a consumer, you would have the power to read and understand how that product or service is performing for other consumers. I mean, I don't buy anything off of Amazon without reading the reviews. Mm-hmm. I don't buy anything.
Or Yelp for a restaurant.
Or Yelp, right. I mean, this is everywhere. We've never, as American consumers, had the ability to really understand that to a large scale of post-secondary decisions. I mean, that's some of the largest and most critical decisions we're going to make as adults, is what to study and where to study. And the Strata Education Network and Gallup poll took this on in 2017. And what they did was they started polling about 350 adults a day. And they're doing this for 3 years. So I believe the project is set to end in 2019. But 350 adults every day, asking them how they feel about their post-secondary choices and decisions.
So what has come back so far?
Most Americans have second thoughts about the decisions that they made. And most Americans, 51% of Americans, if they could, they'd go back and make a different post-secondary choice.
We're living in this time of the intelligent machine, for example, robots, artificial intelligence with capabilities that were once unique to people, are now powering technologies that could extend or deepen our lives or pull the rug out from under our futures. So is it becoming more challenging to know whether we educate ourselves or train ourselves today will be in demand tomorrow?
Yes. And it's another reason why businesses have to get front and center of these education conversation. The rate of change of technology, what it's doing to the workplace, it is disruption every single day. Our jobs are changing. The skills that we need to have to go into those roles because of the technological changes, it's changing. And last time I was on, we talked about this too, is that 65% of the kindergartners sitting in class today, we don't even know what their jobs are going to be.
Right.
We don't know what their jobs will be by the time they enter into post-secondary and career choices. So the question for us as adults that are helping to lead these charge is, how do you prepare for a workforce that hasn't been created yet? And the truth is, and we don't know what those changes will be, but if businesses become front and center of this conversation, they'll know what those changes will be in real time. So that information can get over to the classrooms and to those educators much, much sooner.
So are there discussions going on about how to go about that, how to better integrate business and its forward thinking with the classroom?
Yes, we do. The Kentucky Chamber's Workforce Center has a talent pipeline management system that we use. And it's the United States Chambers. They created it. It's in about 65 communities across the United States. And Kentucky was one of the first states to implement it statewide. And so whether it's employers getting in the classroom, whether it's employers getting into post-secondary or any of the populations you can think of out there, it's a way of how we convene employers and do real-time demand planning. So looking at what are those critical occupations? What are those skill needs that they have? And what are those projections look like in 1 or 2 or 5 years? And once we convene those employers by sector, by region, we do that real-time demand planning. And then looking at those skill needs, go to the right supplier, whether it's K through 12 or post-secondary, and give them those real-time signals so that educators aren't having to wait on those signal changes before, honestly, it's too late and employers making another change.
This Strata study, coupled with what we were talking about just a second ago about it being very difficult to predict what the job market's going to look like 5 years from now, in particular because of the influences of ever-changing technology, must make for some pretty sleepless nights for career and guidance counselors, I would think. And I hope to talk to a few in the future, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we put a lot of pressure on career and guidance counselors. And what we saw from the Strata Education Network and Gallup study, we saw most Americans have post-secondary regret. And what we also saw from the study is that most Americans receive advice on what to study from a high school guidance counselor or a parent. The advice received from those two sources, the guidance counselors and parents, those are actually the most unsatisfied adults with their post-secondary choices. And the most satisfied consumers received advice on what to study from an employer or an on-the-job experience, a work-based learning opportunity, a manager, an internship. Those are the happiest consumers of their post-secondary choices. But the piece there is that it's also the smallest sample. It's the fewest resources that our high school kids have is that connection to work or business. Most of the time, they have the guidance counselors and the parents. It's just another signal that businesses have to get into K through 12. They have to support those guidance counselors. It's almost impossible for a guidance counselor to do all of the responsibilities and administrative work that they have on their plate, sometimes juggling 600 kids, and then to think that they could also play the role of a career coach. And same with parent. I say that on stage a lot and have to ask the audience not to get offended, but most of the time it also comes from a parent that's not in that particular job. And it really does take that business leader, that employer, going into those classrooms and helping.
Sure, parents are as busy as anybody, very difficult to keep up with these things. This will be continuing. I hope we can revisit with further results down the line. For our listeners, if you want to check it out, go to Strata, that's S-T-R-A-D-A, strataeducation.gallup.com, and you'll come across a video there that will walk you through all this. Pretty interesting. Beth Davison is Executive Director of the Kentucky Chamber's Workforce Center, and we thank you, Beth.
Thank you so much, Tom. We really appreciate the opportunity to get back on.
We also welcome back Bill Goodman, Executive Director of Kentucky Humanities. Bill has been talking with a Lexington-based writer whose focus is rooted in her own heritage as a Native American.
It isn't every day a writer is nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and it is even more rare when that writer is a Kentuckian. Margaret Verbal of Lexington remembers well the call she received a couple of years ago telling her that Maud's Line, her debut novel chronicling the life and loves of members of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, had been selected as a finalist for the Pulitzer.
The phone rang. And it was my agent's assistant. And she said, I have Lynn on the line for you. She said, she's got some really good news. Have you heard? And I said, no, I haven't heard anything. And she said, well, I'll let Lynn tell you. So Lynn Nesbitt, who is my agent and who, you know, was Tom Wolfe's agent and Ronald Reagan's agent. I mean, Lynn's a powerhouse of an agent. And she said, Margaret, she said, I have some really good news. She said, now, she says, I want you to understand, she said, you did not win this prize, but you are one of two runners up. And she said, it's going to change your life. It took 2 or 3 months for it to settle in, and it did change my life.
Verbal's new novel, Cherokee America, is a prequel written before Maud's Line. Both novels are based on the Native American history of her family in Oklahoma.
You know, my family, they didn't sit around and talk about being Indians any more than white people sit around and talk about being white people. We did have the tribal attorney in our family. He was my mother's first cousin. And, oh, he was an encyclopedia of Cherokee history. His name was Earl Boyd Pierce. And Earl could talk forever about Cherokee history, and he really influenced me more than anybody else. And, of course, you know, there were Indians in my family that weren't literate, too. I mean, we're not talking about people who have educations. They didn't, you know, they didn't go to high school. You know, they went part of the way through grade school. My mother had first cousins who had never learned to read English. So there was not a lot of less talk about history. And also the history was unpleasant. And there's a tendency, I think, in people who have been through really bad things, you know, not to want to dwell on those for their kids. They want to send their children out into the world to try to get along. So there wasn't a lot of emphasis on conflict.
When did you start thinking about your next novel, your new novel, Cherokee America?
I started thinking about it in about the year 2000.
Were you writing it at the same time you were writing Maud's Line?
No, I wrote it before Maud's Line.
That's why it's a prequel.
That's why it's a prequel. And I wrote Maud's Line in order to get it published. And I had trouble getting an agent for Cherokee America. And I realized basically what I was told again and again was, well, you know, we sort of like this, but, you know, we can't sell Indians. And we don't know how to market Indians. Well, since then, Indians have become very fashionable. The other problem was that it's got a lot of characters in it. And for first novels, people in New York think first novels should follow one character through. So when I finally came to terms with that, I thought, okay, I'll sit down. I'll write a novel. It'll carry one character through. And it'll simplify it. And it'll make them happy. And so I did. I wrote Maud's Line in about 14 months. And it sold. And I structured it so that the people that are old in Maud's Line or young in Cherokee America.
That's pretty fascinating for people to understand the writing process and what you did to bring life to Maud's Line, which, of course, you are known for at this point. Cherokee America, how long did it take you to write it? And when you finished that, did you shop it around and did they just not give you encouragement that it was going to be something that they could buy and then sell for you?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I wrote on it on and off for, well, from about the year, 2001, 2002, somewhere around in there, until I finally gave up in 2014 and thought, well, I'm just going to have to give in and write a novel, you know, that they can sell up in New York. You know, I had figured out what they could sell or had been told what they could sell, and so I wrote a novel that they could sell.
Years ago, Margaret's grandmother, who her second novel is dedicated to, gave her the thought that she could base a novel on the protagonist of Cherokee America, Cherokee America Singer.
This character, Cherokee America Singer, is based on a woman named Cherokee America Rogers. And I found this woman's grave in what used to be the old Cherokee National Cemetery, which is Citizen Cemetery outside of Fort Gibson, Oklahoma now. And I was visiting my grandfather's grave at the time. Granddaddy had just died, and I probably had just graduated from college. And I came home, and I told Grandma, she knew I'd been to the cemetery, and I told her I saw this great marker, this great gravestone. It's beautiful. And it had this fabulous name on it, Cherokee America Rogers. And Grandma just laughed, and she said, "You found Aunt Chuck." I said, "You knew her?" She said, "Yes."
In Cherokee America, Verbal writes about a large cast of characters, and there is a reason.
The notion of let's just write about one single character and follow that character through and, you know, make that character a heroine or a hero, that's a real white way of thinking. Indians are always thinking about the group. So it's really hard to write a novel about Indians that's just about one or two people. That just strips the very Indianness out of them. And, you know, if you read Tommy Orange's They're There, he's writing about a lot of people. The whole notion of how to live in a Native American world is a notion of an interconnectedness that seems to have been completely lost in most of our modern culture, which is necessary if you really want to write about Indians.
I asked Verbal to comment on recent events surrounding Native Americans in the United States, from the Covington Catholic issue at the Lincoln Memorial to U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren's controversy over her Indian heritage.
It's no accident that it has been published now when it wasn't published before. Indian concerns are important now. People are buying Indian concerns. And so New York and Boston and the publishing industry is trying to respond to that. And whereas 10 years ago it was the same book, but nobody was talking about it. So Indian concerns are having a, I want to say renaissance, but that's not true because it's never had a first time. But it's in vogue now. And I hope it stays that way. I mean, there's a lot to be said. I still have a lot to say about it. And I know that other people do too.
Verbal visits her Native American home in Oklahoma several times a year. She'll be on book tour in the coming weeks. For Kentucky Humanities and Eastern Standard, I'm Bill Goodman.
Coming up after the break, are you starved for information about the arts in the region? Undermane, the nonprofit cultural affairs magazine, is out to satisfy your hunger with Critical Mass 3, a discussion to be led by Matt Distel, exhibitions director at the Carnegie in Covington.
It will be interesting to sort of have a lot of different perspectives on what is the current state of arts writing in this region, and where can we improve and where can we create new opportunities for that to happen? And, you know, not thinking necessarily about art criticism as a promotional tool, but as a tool to sort of help strengthen the work that's being shown and the audience that comes to see it.
Distel sits down with arts editor and Undermain co-publisher Christine Huskisson with details about Critical Mass 3. Plus, details about this year's Kentucky Crafted Arts Market. It's coming to Alltech Arena at the Kentucky Horse Park near Lexington. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through the 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
A lot of good stuff going on in March. Not only is the official start of spring just a couple of weeks away, artists all around the Ohio Valley region are coming out of hibernation to show us what they've been up to as winter kept them busy in their studios. We have a couple of events to bring to your attention. The first is meant, in these times of fragmenting media, to encourage and support more writing about the art happening all around our region. Eastern Standard contributing arts editor Christine Huskisson sat down with Matt Distel, the exhibitions director at the Carnegie in Covington. Matt is this year's moderator of the annual Undermain event, Critical Mass 3, coming up on March 15th and 16th.
Hey, Matt.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
That's great. Before we jump into the Critical Mass series, tell our audience a little bit about yourself. How did you become interested in art and maybe how you came to your position as exhibitions director at the Carnegie?
Well, I studied art history and always considered myself more of a bureaucrat, and sort of that led me into some curating. And I've bounced around the art world, art scene in Cincinnati mostly, and Northern Kentucky. I've seen the art world from a variety of different angles, from commercial galleries, nonprofits, more community-minded activities as well.
Yeah, and you're really familiar with the traditional role of curating. And I know in September, I think, of 2018, you really decided to change that up a little bit, and you started a thing called open source. Could
Correct.
You tell us a little bit about that and how you curate exhibits?
Yeah, after doing this for, you know, a couple of decades, I've started thinking a lot about how what we do as an institution impacts artists. And I started thinking a lot about, well, what does it look like if an institution says we want to help the artists that we're exhibiting? And I came to this sort of realization, I would say, after talking to a lot of artists about what it is they want and need, that more than exhibitions, they need connections and they need people to discover them and offer them new opportunities. So I just changed up kind of slightly. It still looks the same. It still looks like art from the outside world, but it's really more about sort of how we build the exhibitions. We build the exhibitions through connecting to a series of outside curators and making connections for artists to sort of find those people.
So this new philosophy really helps build dialogue in the community. It's not just your voice.
Correct. I sort of removed myself a little bit from that process.
Yeah. I find that dovetails interestingly into Undermain's goals. We have something similar going on, trying to collaborate with multiple people and maybe even create a digital online space where artists and arts professionals can talk. And that's why I think Critical Mass 3 is going to be really special this year.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, yeah. For our listeners, I feel like I should give them a little bit of a history of Critical Mass. The series itself emerged as a way to bring life to Undermain's goal of becoming this digital meeting place, if you will, and specifically to explore the role of art criticism in the arts. Critical Mass 1, as you well know, was held in 2016 at the University of Kentucky Art Museum with Stuart Horodner moderating. Critical Mass 2 in 2018 was held at KMAC with Joey Yates moderating and a special featured guest, Dan Cameron. Matt, you were there for Critical Mass 2, and I think you probably had some takeaways from that, maybe even feed into this third series. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it was a really lively conversation, and that's what I enjoyed a lot about that. And I also do feel like, especially with Dan there, there was an interesting sort of perspective from the outside in. And I think it's important that we've maintained that, but also so we've spoken to, we're bringing in a lot of people into this Critical Mass 3 that are talking about what it's like to sort of exist in the Midwest and speak about the art world from that perspective, sort of the inside out.
Yeah, it was important for Undermain as well because Dan Cameron was the first critic in residence for the Great Meadows Foundation and Hin House. And this year we'll be featuring Natalia Zuluaga, who is the second critic in residence. I do think Dan brought a lot of interesting points to the discussion at that point. And I know that this is feeding into your new title. You have called this In the Mid, if you will, Critical Mass 3 In the Mid. And regionalism is, in fact, the goal to discuss regionalism.
Yeah, we wanted to sort of look at what are the actual practical aspects of making art work sort of outside of the major art markets, mm-hmm. and see where that leads and where that leads the conversation and how criticism plays a role in all of that.
So you have elected to address regionalism, and you've also brought in some real powerhouses to do this. I think we should talk about a few of them. But let me first introduce, if I could, Natalia Zuluaga. Because she is our second critic in residence coming on board, she's a Miami-based independent curator and researcher, and she's also, again, this year's critic in residence for Great Meadows Foundation. The goal of that residency is that the critic in residence will help strengthen and support the growth of Kentucky artists by essentially going to visiting their studios. And I think that she's done that in Louisville and Lexington and up in Northern Kentucky as well. And you've got a lot of other people. Let's hear about a few of them.
Yeah. And I think also with Natalia and the critic in residence, it really dovetails nicely with what we're doing at the Carnegie, which is we want to make sure that every piece of art that's on the wall in our exhibitions is the result of an introduction. And those introductions are coming by way of studio visits. So that is a foundational element toward building exhibitions, quote unquote, is really more about building those relationships. So we wanted to bring in some curators and writers and critics who are able to sort of offer those artists some new opportunities. To that end, our panel will include Natalia, as well as Sarah Rose Sharp, who is a writer for Hyperallergic, and she is an artist as well. And she's coming in from Detroit, which I think Detroit has some interesting overlaps with how this region also handles art. And in some ways they're ahead, in some ways they're behind us. So that'll be an interesting perspective, I think, and somebody who writes for a national magazine. We have Annie Delaria, who is a professor of art history at Miami University, assistant professor. And she's working on a book about public art, and she thinks about public art in very expansive ways. She's also one of the curators who is working with me on open source. And we also have Valentine Umansky, who is a curatorial fellow of lens-based art at the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati. And she has moved all over the world and has curated a lot of interesting projects and always finds herself sort of in these sort of spaces between the art poles, I guess you could say, and has taken that on as an interesting aspect of her research.
So for those of you listening, it might be a sort of a boring thought to sit and listen to four people talk about art. This year, we've decided to really make this a little bit different by introducing pop-up art talks, if you will. You have five different artists coming on board, and each of them will be given, 10, 15 minutes to sort of talk about their work?
Yeah. So I think the thing that is different about this talk is it's existing inside of an art space. So it's inside the gallery. So we're kind of surrounded by the work that we're talking about, as opposed to it being a lecture hall or some other kind of neutral space. So it's kind of just built up in there. And the artist that we're bringing in is David Wisher, who is a printmaker artist from University of Kentucky, Lindsay Whittle, who runs a gallery space called Peak in Covington, Kentucky, and has a show up at the Contemporary Arts Center right now. Her collaborator is Sky Kubakub, who is actually a Chicago-based artist, who makes these really wonderful, lively, expansive performances, and that will happen the night before Critical Mass 3. Do not want to miss Sky's performance.
On March 15th, that's from 5 to 8, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Harry Sanchez Jr., who is also a Dayton, Kentucky-based artist, making really interesting political work, and Joey Versosa, who is another Northern Kentucky-based artist, making really interesting conceptual work. And they'll just kind of pop up. These will be sort of like these kind of quick hit, just kind of light discussions, so sort of talking about introducing a work while standing in front of it, and hopefully it'll engage a dialogue as opposed to just, hey, here's my art.
Yeah, sure. I think that'd be really nice. The entire symposium, if you will, is going to be videotaped. So we'll have that on Undermain, just as we did for Critical Mass 2. And I guess just to finish up before we give them the specifics of time and date, what do you hope we could take out of this and move to Critical Mass 4 when we do next year?
Well, I think it will be interesting to sort of have a lot of different perspectives on what is the current state of arts writing in this region, and where can we improve and where can we create new opportunities for that to happen? And, you know, not thinking necessarily about art criticism as a promotional tool, but as a tool to sort of help strengthen the work that's being shown and the audience that comes to see it. You know, one thing that I think will also you know, that again does sound very dry and boring, but you know, we're going to have Bloody Marys and mimosas involved
as well. That's right. So, that's right. And we have one free drink ticket per person if you arrive at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
The event does start on Saturday, March 16th at 10 o'clock for your free drink ticket. And please wander around to see the exhibitions. And then at 10:30, we'll gather and begin to introduce some of the people. Natalia, hopefully being on the mic by about 11 o'clock. And I'm assuming then you're going to really open this up to questions from the audience and that sort of thing, correct?
Yeah, we want it to be a back and forth, definitely. Yeah,
great. After Critical Mass 1, where we had about 50 people, Critical Mass 2 garnered nearly 90 people. Critical Mass 3 has a whole lot more potential, so we do encourage our listeners to make a reservation. It's a free event, but you need to make a reservation so that we know you're coming. And you can do that at reservations@under-main.com, and the sooner the better, so we know how many mimosas to bring.
It's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. Matt, thank you. I want to thank you for not only agreeing to moderate, but helping us coordinate this really marvelous cast of people so that we can increase the dialogue.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
That's Christine Huskisson, president and co-publisher of Undermain, with Matt Distel, exhibitions director for the Carnegie in Covington, Kentucky. And again, that event is Critical Mass 3, being held on March 15th from 5 to 8 p.m., and on March 16th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Carnegie in Covington. You can get more details online at under-main.com, and you can make your free reservations by emailing reservations@under-main.com. Tom Musgrave is with us. He's with the Kentucky Arts Council, where they're getting ready for this year's Kentucky Crafted Market, and he's here to give us the details. Greetings, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So when and where is this year's market?
This year's market is March 16th and 17th. Those are the public days. The time on March 16th, Saturday, is 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And on Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We're back in Lexington this year after being in Louisville last year, but we are at a new location in Lexington, the Alltech Arena at the Kentucky Horse Park. It's not our first go-around at the Horse Park, but it is our first time at Alltech Arena, and we're really excited about the new venue.
And that's a much bigger space. How do you expect that will change things, or will it change things?
It's a nice facility. People will not have to compete for parking because we're the only thing at that venue. So when you're parking, you're not competing with any other downtown activities or anything like that. Parking is very close to the facility. Traffic is relatively light on Ironworks Pike. We hope that the proximity to I-75 will really add to the ease of people getting to the market. We're really excited about being at Alltech Arena.
I've made my way to the horse park, found a place to park, walk through the front doors. What am I going to find?
You're going to find about 120 visual and craft artists from around the state, all who have been juried into, or most who have been juried into the Kentucky Crafted program. And we throw that word juried around. That means they've gone through an evaluation process to be juried into our arts marketing program. In addition, you're going to find, folks who are Kentucky proud food vendors. We have a good relationship with the Agriculture Commission, and they are supportive of us having Kentucky proud food vendors there. There's also a few selected out-of-state artists who are in their own state's juried programs that we have reciprocal agreements with. It's the best art and craft under one roof that you're going to find all year in the state of Kentucky.
And the Arts Council is providing a great consumer experience here, a great opportunity to do some one-stop shopping for holidays and for gifts and that kinds of thing, or for collecting. But there is a larger mission. Tell us about that a little bit.
People often ask us what makes a good market, and they want to get it like attendance and dollar figures. For us, a good market is that the artists have a good experience there, that they sell, that they make the appropriate business contacts, because we do have a wholesale only day set aside for them just for that purpose, that they make good business contacts, that they make personal contact with people who really, you know, dig their work and like, oh, I'm going to contact you again and talk about getting some more, maybe commissions. So it's all about not just giving the consumer a good experience and exposure to a diverse array of artwork, but it's also about supporting the artists who come there and show that work.
If somebody wants to know more about this event, is there someplace they can go online?
Absolutely. They can go to kycrafted.org. There will be some general information that that we've just talked about, the where and when, but also a link to the market program, as well as the lineup of musicians that will be performing on the Kentucky stage. We have 13 members of the or acts from the our juried performing artist directory that will be there performing live on Saturday and Sunday.
Tom Musgrave is Communications Director, Kentucky Arts Council. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
On next week's Eastern Standard, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell was recently on Capitol Hill urging Congress to find ways to get more Americans working again. He called it a very troubling concern that the U.S. labor force participation remains so low compared with rates in other countries, especially for young men and for women. Well, it happens that there is a national focus on our workforce challenges. Leading the effort is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and for about a year now, Kentucky has been engaged in a pilot project to implement the Chamber's Talent Pipeline Management Strategy. We talk about this with the Chamber's Vice President for Policy, Cheryl Oldham.
We don't go a day here without hearing from a senior business executive that says, you know, even in this tight labor market, we are having a difficulty finding the talent that we're looking for. And so I think, you know, and we see, you know, there's lots of statistics out there, right? 60% of jobs going unfilled for extensive periods of time. 40% of businesses say they can't take on new work because they haven't filled critical positions within their enterprise. And so it's, you know, impacting the bottom line.
This and more on next week's edition of Eastern Standard. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1. The All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. And now you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, available for Apple and Android devices. Eastern Standard is also available as a podcast. You'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.